Macromedia.com.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It was a time of striped pants, suspenders, and cigars. Hotshot hacks like H.L. Mencken hauled their portable typewriters off to presidential conventions, where pounding away at the keys, they also pounded away at the Coolidges and the Hardings and the Hoovers. Mencken wrote books and edited magazines, but he never lost his taste for daily journalism. There is something delightful, he once wrote, about getting an idea on paper while it's still hot and charming, and seeing it in print before it begins to pale and stale. Mencken's style of criticism, his harsh dismissal of the bourgeoisie, was the rage in the 20s, but it wasn't to last. His feud with FDR alienated many of his admirers, and recent releases of his diary show a man who was intolerant, spiteful of his friends, and deeply anti-Semitic. Yet just a few years ago, contemporary thinkers put their signatures to a letter saying that Mencken still stands as a tremendous liberating force in American culture. Well, Connection listeners, do you buy that? Does H.L. Mencken's prose qualify him for critical acclaim despite the narrow-minded views he espoused 60, 70 years ago? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour is Terry Teachout. Terry is himself a writer and a columnist. He's written a new biography of Mencken. It's called The Skeptic, A Life of H.L. Mencken. Welcome to the studio.
It's good to be here.
He would have hated that music, wouldn't he?
He would. He loathed jazz, and the thought of listening to East St. Louis Toodaloo by Duke Ellington would not have pleased him in the slightest.
He was an odd collection of preferences for someone who cast himself as this critic of all things.
He was a mama's boy. He was a Victorian. He was a man who had led an utterly conventional private life and then went upstairs to the home office and sat down at the portable Corona and hammered out these thunderbolts that he aimed at conventional behavior and thought in America. He's cloven in all sorts of different directions by contradiction.
Now, in your book, you quite carefully take us through his early years when he learned to read, and I can't help but think that, gosh, by the time that guy was 15 years old, he was who he was going to be by the sheer volume of what he read.
Yeah, he had a lot of books under his belt. The family library survives. The old Mencken House still exists in Baltimore, and you can see all these collected editions of Mark Twain and Oscar Wilde, as a matter of fact. They had a complete Oscar Wilde in the family home. And Mencken, like so many bookish kids, just chewed up books, went through them like termites. And then his father, when he was a young boy, gave him a printing press for a Christmas present, and that was it. He got the smell of printer's ink in his nose, and from that time on, he felt the romance of journalism, and he never lost it.
And when you reflect back on all the time that you've spent with him, is it the writing of the man that brings you back to what you respect about him?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Though you can't really separate the writing from the personality to begin with, Mencken is so remarkably, well, as actors say, he's present in his writings. You feel that you're face to face with him. You feel that you hear him talking. And in fact, in surviving recordings of his voice in conversation, you realize that he wrote the same way that he talked. So there's a complete fusion of style and man in the writing. And that means for good and bad alike.
We actually have a little bit of Mencken, and we should listen to some of that. This is a piece from a 1948 radio interview in which Mencken's talking about what he thinks of people who write letters to the editor.
The volume of mail that comes in to a magazine or a newspaper or a radio station is no index of anything, except that you happen to attract a lot of idiots, because most people that write letters to newspapers are fools.
Didn't pull any punches, did
he? Not ever.
We've also taken, and this is actually a piece of Mencken's writing that you chose for the book, The Skeptic. Tell me, and I'd like to hear you read it, Terry, but tell me why it is you selected this as an example of what he does.
This is an essay, an excerpt from an essay called On Being an American, which, if my memory is serving me, he wrote around 1926. And I chose it in the book as an exemplar of what Mencken's style is like, the way he puts words and sentences together, his prose rhythm, and the way that it's all tied up with the way he presents himself as a kind of dramatic character, H.L. Mencken, the author. And if I had to choose one passage from one essay to give people a sense of what Mencken sounds like on the page, this is what I would pick. He wrote, "Here in America, the general average of intelligence, of knowledge, of competence, of integrity, of self-respect, of honor, is so low that any man who knows his trade, does not fear ghosts, has read 50 good books, and practices the common decencies, stands out as brilliantly as a wart on a bald head, and is thrown willy-nilly into a meager and exclusive aristocracy. And here, more than anywhere else that I know of or have heard of, the daily panorama of human existence, of private and communal folly, the unending procession of governmental extortions and chicaneries, of commercial brigandages and throat slittings, of theological buffooneries, of aesthetic ribaldries, of legal swindles and harlotries, of miscellaneous rogueries, villainies, imbecilities, grotesqueries, and extravagances, is so inordinately gross and preposterous, so perfectly brought up to the highest conceivable amperage, so steadily enriched with an almost fabulous daring and originality, that only the man who was born with a petrified diaphragm can fail to laugh himself to sleep every night and to awake every morning with all the eager, unflagging expectation of a Sunday school superintendent touring the Paris peep shows."
Terry Teachout reading the words of H.L. Mencken in his new book, The Skeptic, A Life of H.L. Mencken. I guess you read a lot of what he wrote in preparation for this.
Everything I could get my hands on. I spent 10 years working on this book, and I spent the first 2 years in his archive doing nothing but reading and taking notes. Mencken left behind, in addition to his huge mass of published writings, 100,000 personal letters that have been located so far, and a large number of unpublished manuscripts that were sealed at the time of his death and opened many years later, a diary, an autobiography of his work as a journalist, and one of his work as a newspaperman.
Is there such a thing as reading too much H.L. Mencken?
Well, I didn't get tired of it. The wonderful thing about Mencken's style is that it doesn't cloy, because there's a lot of vinegar in it, for one thing. You know, it's not like a sugary sort of writer where it begins to turn your stomach. It has that acid quality that keeps you going. But the danger if you are yourself a writer in reading a lot of H.L. Mencken is that it starts to stick. Those characteristic turns of phrases, the particular words he likes, they work their way into your vocabulary. And if you are not very careful and consciously aware of it, you end up being a Mencken imitator. I knew I was going to be spending a lot of time reading Mencken's writings, and I was scrupulously careful during that decade to keep the Mencken-isms out of my own prose and out of this book as well.
And do you think you succeed, or do you learn from the man? Do you end up saying, that works, I should use that? You write a lot, Terry.
Oh, yeah. I learned a lot about prose rhythm from him. It's just that you really have to avoid his distinctive tricks, those words he loves, especially the ones he coined, like bourgeoisie. I would never use that in my own writing. Or a phrase of his that I especially like is, instead of from top to bottom, he'll say from snout to tail. I do allow myself to use that now that the book is finished.
I want to flip ahead to that point where his diaries and other papers were opened in the late 1980s and the issue of his anti-Semitism, because it's what comes to people's minds so often when you talk about Mencken. There's a passage, you use it in the book, where he says, "The sharp, unyielding separateness of the Jews, based on their assertive racial egoism, marks them off as strangers everywhere." I don't need to go on in this.
Right, you know. We all know about that. Now we do. And during Mencken's lifetime, the question of anti-Semitism was mooted not infrequently in the public press. It was triggered by a book he wrote called Treatise on the Gods, which was published in 1930, if I remember correctly, in which I think that's actually where the passage you just read out comes from. I've read so much Mencken over the years that I can't always quote reliably. But that passage led to articles in the Jewish press asking, is H.L. Mencken an anti-Semite? And he would always say no, that he simply did the Jews the honor of treating them the way he treated every other group, which was with the back of his hand.
Scorn right. And disdain. Yeah.
That's right. But I knew that this was an issue when I started working on the book, and I read everything published and unpublished by Mencken that I could get my hands on, and statements by people who knew him, and tried to plumb as well as I could the question of this troubling attitude that he had. And I left off until the very end of writing this book, the last year that I was working on it, writing the passages in it that dealt with the question of anti-Semitism, because I really wanted to give him the fairest possible shake. But at the end, there was no way to get around it. Mencken was, I think, even by the standards, not of the 19th century, but the standards that he lived into as a man, he was an anti-Semite. There's just no getting around
it. He's scribbling about his own editor, Alfred Knopf.
Although one must take these things in context. Alfred Knopf was both Jewish and an anti-Semite. He was that particular kind of Jewish anti-Semite who came from German Jewish stock and had no use for Eastern European Jews. So whenever you make statements like this, they must always be placed into the relevant historical context. Mencken was an anti-Semite like Dostoevsky, like Henry James, like an enormous number of people who came from his time. It's one thing to say, as I say unequivocally in my book, that he was, and it's another thing to go beyond that and say, and therefore we should not read him, and therefore we should not take him seriously.
So help me with the next step of that, setting it aside. I mean, if you can set it aside.
But the phrase I use is, it's like I don't know anything about sports, but they tell me in baseball and the records, if there's anything equivocal about your statistic, they put an asterisk by it. Well, I think there should always be an asterisk by Mencken's standing in the statistics book of literary reputation. He was an American classic, and he was an anti-Semite.
10 years you spent with his papers.
10 years.
Room at the Pratt Library in Baltimore.
Yes, Mencken left his papers to the Baltimore Public Library, which is called the Enoch Pratt Free Library because of a man from the Civil War who gave them a lot of money to endow it. He left his papers and his copyrights because he didn't go to college. He thought that the Baltimore Public Library system was his alma mater, and this was his payback to them. So they maintained the Mencken papers and do so quite beautifully and wonderfully. And there is a room on the top floor of the Baltimore Public Library behind a bright blue door. You open it up, it says Mencken Room on the outside, and suddenly it's as though you're in the library of a men's club from about, 1923 or something like that. It's a little shabby, and it's lined with books, and it has great chandeliers, and I spent 10 years in that room reading everything that was in there, and it was great fun.
The product of that is a book called The Skeptic, A Life of H.L. Mencken. Terry Teachout is my guest. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to hear your thoughts on H.L. Mencken, where he fits in the pantheon of American writers. Is he a journalist? Is he an author? How do you see him? And does his writing still stand up for you today? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Terry Teachout. He's got a new book. It's called The Skeptic, A Life of H.L. Mencken. Now, you'll know Terry from his work as music critic of commentary, covering classical music and dance for Time magazine. He writes about books for the New York Times Book Review, the Wall Street Journal, and National Review. He's got his own books out. And before we go to the next clip of H.L. Mencken, I want to put it on the record that Terry Teachout also does work on radio.
Because I love radio.
Mencken's scorn extended to those in his own profession, and he had particularly harsh words for those of us who dabble in the dark arts of electronic journalism. This is H.L. Mencken, recorded in 1948.
As soon as a television or any kind of radio enterprise gets into a newspaper, an enormous number of men, including some of the best men, become radio crooners, not newspaper men.
They become actors.
Actors, yeah. They get stage struck, in brief. That's the truth.
So here we are, a couple of crooners,
stage-struck
actors, talking about Mr. Mencken.
Who recorded that interview shortly after covering the first presidential conventions ever to be televised. And he filed a dispatch about the first time that they turned on the TV lights at the convention. Said it was hot enough to fry an egg on the bald head of a politician.
Now, was he objecting to the way that the television lights changed what was happening at the convention, or was he objecting to the whole idea of televising it in the first place?
I don't think he quite had time to digest how it would go out over the air. To realize how television would change our perceptions of it, would change the events by changing our perceptions of them. And as for radio, which he did genuinely disdain, although he did some of it in the 30s, in 1948, Mencken had a stroke, and after that he couldn't read or write. And he took his pleasure after that from listening to music, which had been the great love of his life. And that's when he discovered that the radio wasn't such a bad thing. And on the day before he died, in fact, he spent the afternoon listening to a radio broadcast of an opera.
You write about his participation in the Scopes trial.
Yes.
Dayton, Tennessee. Did he actually advise the prosecution? That's never really clear.
He sure did. He was into it up to his ears. Even though he was covering it as a journalist for the Baltimore Sun, he also helped in the planning by the ACLU and the defense team for the trial. And he claims, he's our only witness to it, but we have no reason to doubt him, he claims that it was his idea to put William Jennings Bryan on the stand, which of course is the great climax of Inherit the Wind, the movie that is based on the Scopes trial, in which Bryan was induced to confess that he didn't think man was a mammal. Mencken took credit for that. And, of course, in our day and age, a journalist who was involved with the defense team for a trial that he was covering would be cashiered before the end of the day.
Okay.
But standards were a little different in 1925.
And yet, when you look at that time, I mean, it was a fascinating clash of those who were looking at evolution as what children ought to be taught, and all the people who believed otherwise.
Right.
And Mencken, William Jennings Bryan dies, what, a day after the case?
About a week after the case.
This man has run for president. He's a big public figure in the United States at that time.
He had been Secretary of State, the only Secretary of State at that time, the only cabinet member to have resigned over a matter of principle, because Bryan was opposed to American entry into World War I. He was immensely respected, and yet Mencken saw him as nothing more than the leader of the fundamentalists. And religious fundamentalism was a new idea in American life in 1925, and Mencken thought it was a tremendous threat to American liberty and the freedom of the mind. And he saw Bryan as the symbol of that, and he thought that if that symbol could be discredited, the movement would be discredited as well.
So, Connection listeners, think about this. Big public intellectual has just died, and a journalist of the day, H.L. Mencken, writes this about him. These are Mencken's words. He seemed only a poor clod, like those around him, deluded by a childish theology, full of an almost pathological hatred of all learning, all human dignity, all beauty, all fine and noble things. And even 20-some-odd years later, in conversation about how he felt about William Jennings Bryan, he spoke about him in that same interview we've been listening to.
It was a dreadful thing to look at a man like Bryan, a man with his opportunities in the world, to see what he had come to intellectually in his old age. It was a tragedy in a way, but I should add at once, it wasn't a tragedy to me. I enjoyed it tremendously.
And I have to tell you, Terry, when I read the words and heard him, I thought to myself, wow, was nothing sacred to this man?
Nothing whatsoever. Nothing whatsoever except liberty. He believed, as he said, in liberty up to and including the utmost limits of the tolerable. Other than that, everything was up for grabs. Everything could be made fun of. Everything could be insulted. Mencken, above all, was a man who, seated at the typewriter, or in this instance in front of a microphone, was prepared to say exactly what he thought with all the bark on.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Newport, Rhode Island. Shelley's calling in. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
I read Mr. Teachout's book, and I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And what he just said about Mencken's writings and his saying exactly what he felt, that's what I love about him. And I've always liked his writing. His humor is absolutely brilliant. And this Mr. Teachout's book prompted me to get Treatise on the Gods. And that was, he's right, it was published in 1930, March 1930. And then I enjoyed that, too. Then I passed that on to a friend who sent me a note and which said, I read through Mencken's book. The problems he raised back in 1930 have been avidly discussed by scholars and theologians ever since. The discussion is going on. So I enjoyed that note, too.
I like that, yeah.
And I wonder if you ever heard this story, perhaps apocryphal. I don't know, but it's one of my favorites. H.L. Mencken received a letter from someone who laid him out in lavender, and you're a ne'er-do-well, and you're a scoundrel, and so on and so forth. And he wrote back, "Dear sir, perhaps you are right."
You know, that is one of the great pieces of Mencken Apocrypha, and it may be true. He's perfectly capable of having written a letter like that. The story that is true is that when Mencken was working at the Baltimore Sun, he not only wrote a weekly column, but he edited the letters to the editor section. And he said whenever anybody wrote in to say what a scoundrel and evil fellow he was, he made a point of giving that letter extra special placement in the paper.
Shelley, thanks so much for your call.
Oh, thank you.
1-800-423-8255.
I've spent a lot of the last few years chasing down Mencken stories, you know, and Mencken quotes.
Because everybody's got one,
everybody's
right?
got one. Like Dorothy Parker, if somebody says something clever, it must have been Mencken who said it.
Burlington, Vermont. Jerry's on the line. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I enjoy, you know, relatively reading Mencken. You know, he certainly was an interesting and well-read writer. I'd like to make, like, 2 points. One is, the main thing that bothers me about him is his elitism. And my favorite writer of the 20th century, I guess, nonfiction writer, was A.J. Liebling, who also had a certain amount of elitism. And he would also write occasionally what would now be looked on as a racist or anti-Semitic, and he was Jewish, remark. But it was done with a different intent. I don't think that the same elitism applied. He was a great defender of black people and of Indians. A recent book came out about an article he wrote about Indians way, way back before that was popular. That was in the mid-50s. And I want to bring in another author, J.B. Priestley, who wrote, I proofread a book one time, his three favorite novels, his own three favorite novels of his own, and I'm sorry to be redundant. The first book was really almost virulently anti-Semitic, but in a ridiculing way. It wasn't like kill all the Jews. It wasn't that sort of thing. After World War II, he wrote another book. He included both these books in there. And I believe that what he was doing was saying, I'm sorry, I was wrong. And I don't think that if Mencken were alive today, he would be any bit different from what he was. He would be
In fact, Jerry, he's worse than that, because the people who were his friends when he was alive, it turns out, when his notes were open years after his death, Mencken was sitting at home scribbling these nasty things about them. Is that an accurate characterization?
About some of his friends and colleagues, yes. He left behind private memoranda in which the people that he had been nice to in his private dealings, he thought very ill of. And a couple of them lived long enough to see the sealed papers opened in the 80s, and we're terribly shocked by it. It's interesting that our caller mentions A.J. Liebling, by the way. Liebling, Mencken wrote for The New Yorker. He did some of his best writing for The New Yorker. I'm often asked out on the road when people, I say in this book that I think Mencken was America's greatest journalist, and they'll ask me, well, you know, who was in his rank? And the first name I always give after that is A.J. Liebling. As for whether Mencken would have changed his mind, you know, we just don't know. We know one thing, which was that when Treatise on the Gods, which had that passage about the Jews that first rang the fire bells, was republished after World War II in a revised edition, Mencken left that section out. He removed it silently. And whether that bespoke any change of feeling on his part, I don't know. We can't know. He had a stroke shortly after the war, and after that he wasn't taking in new information. I don't think that his attitudes, his anti-Semitic attitudes, would have changed that much, but it's possible that knowledge of what it came to in World War II might have had an effect on him. But we just don't know.
1-800-423-8255. Jerry, thanks for that. To Brookline, Massachusetts now. Maureen's on the phone. Hi, Maureen.
Good morning. I wondered if Mr. Teachout could tell us something about where this fearlessness came from. Is there anything in his Mencken's upbringing, or how did he get to be such a fearless writer? There are very few like this.
That's an awfully interesting question.
I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Maureen.
Yeah, he credited his family, his upbringing. His father was a skeptic and agnostic in the same way that he was. But, you know, so much of this just, it comes out of oneself. Mencken thought, though, that one of the most significant things about his raising was that he did not go to college, that his father owned and ran a cigar factory, and he wanted young Henry to follow in his footsteps, and Henry wanted to be a journalist. And a couple of weeks after his father died, when Mencken was 18 years old, he got his first job as a cub reporter. He thought that not having spent the time immersed in classes and all of the nonsense that students do, but going right out into the school of life was the thing that shaped him most completely. He was covering the police beat. He was reporting on hangings. He saw politicians in their element when he was a teenager. He became a reporter at the age of 18. And he thought that that was the great formative experience, that he saw life as it was.
He had enormous self-confidence, though. I'm thinking of that part where you're quoting the smackdown that he gets into with Henry James over the quality of American journalism.
Yeah,
the kid
right.
was 20-something years, 22, 23 years old.
That's right, and he takes on Henry James, for whom he never had any use. The thing that I think really sums up Mencken's certainty was that at the age of 23, he started subscribing to a clipping service, and he saved the clips. And this can only be because he knew what he was. He knew that he was a very exceptional man. And he had a pretty good idea that he was going to be famous, and that someday, years later, people like me would want to root around in his papers and find out about him. Now, you can call that arrogance, and I think that Mencken was in some ways an arrogant man, and he was most certainly, as our caller from Vermont said, an elitist. But on the other hand, he was right.
There was a moment in the 20s when he and George Jean Nathan decided to start the American Mercury. When they had it, though, when they struck just the right note for what intellectuals in America wanted to read.
That's right. The right magazine for the right moment. The Mercury launched in January of 1924. And for the next 4.5 years, right up to the Depression, it was a tremendous success. It caught the note of mockery, the feeling that maybe America wasn't as wonderful a place as everybody liked to think it was, that politicians should be made brutal fun of in American culture and fundamentalists, and it rang the bell. It rang the bell, especially with college students. They all wanted to, they carried around the Mercury nobody carries around a magazine like that anymore, you know. The Mercury was at dead center of American popular culture in the first half of the 20s.
And was
second half of the 20s.
Was Mencken's failing that when things changed, he didn't? And
he didn't
report on the Depression, for example. He just ignored it.
No, and of course, a lot of people didn't. Again, the function of a biography and the job of a biographer is to put what surprises us today
into context.
Yes. And it took a long time for people who were not themselves directly affected by the Depression to really take in what had happened. But Mencken was very slow to realize that something fundamental had changed in American life. He was insulated from it in his row house in Baltimore. He did not suffer greatly from it financially. He had gotten out of the market, distrusting it. And so the country changed and he didn't. He really didn't. Mencken thought that Magnetic North was the same way all the way through his life, and he was not a man to look up one day and say, you know, gosh, I was wrong about that.
Let's go to Provincetown. Rick's calling in. Hi, Rick.
Yeah. Boy, I got so much to say.
But, pick your favorite one.
Well, when I originally called in, it was right after you read that first paragraph, and boy, you got to say it rings true. Time has bore him out.
And, it really has.
And also, I think he had a pretty good attitude if he was excited about it, getting up in the morning like a priest in a peep show. I'd say he's an optimist. And also, he was dead on with that when he said that radio broadcast made people starstruck. You got to see that in TV all the time. Now, besides that, I got so much more. I think he got taken in by the power of the press. That's why he was, I don't know, I can't say it, but that's why he was so ballsy.
that's a very interesting observation. I mean, Mencken wrote as critically about his fellow journalists as he did about anybody else in the world. Maybe he was taken in by his own power as a writer, because he held the attention of the American public effortlessly for a very long time. And even to the most realistic and cynical and disabused man, that kind of success perhaps can go to your head.
And do you think that may have happened at an early age?
Possibly. Possibly. Mencken, he certainly fancied himself the ultimate realist, a person who wrote about men as they are rather than as they wish to be seen. And I think by and large he was right about that. I think he tended to be quite right about politicians. They're the only group which, as a group, perhaps one ought to be cynical about. But Mencken was convinced from an early age of his own superiority. He wrote the first book ever written by an American about Friedrich Nietzsche. And I think when he got the idea of the Superman in his craw, he began to think that maybe he was such a man as well.
Terry Teachout is my guest. His new book is called The Skeptic, A Life of H.L. Mencken. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We invite you to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
Listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Terry Teachout. We're talking about his new biography of H.L. Mencken. It's called The Skeptic. And Terry writes about the books that Mencken wrote, points in fact to one in particular called The American Language, first written just after the First World War and then revised over the next 20 years, in which he would take documents that he thought needed rewriting in the American language, among them the Declaration of Independence. And instead of "we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal," Mencken wrote, "all we got to say on this proposition is this. First, me and you is as good as anybody else and maybe a damn sight better. Second, nobody ain't got no right to take away none of our rights. Third, every man has got a right to live, to come and go as he pleases and to have a good time whichever way he likes, so long as he don't interfere with nobody else." Now, that obviously wasn't Mencken's style, but it's in a way, it's kind of like a funny reverse, because he's making fun of the language by quoting, you know, sort of street-level American language of the time, but making fun of the Declaration at the same time.
That's right. And it's also – this is a parody, but it's also serious, because Mencken was – the American language is the first serious study of the divergence of British and American English. Mencken essentially created this field of scholarship, and everybody who came after it, he turned himself into an amateur scholar. Everybody followed in his footsteps. And Mencken was fascinated by American as it was spoken. And even though he himself did not write or talk like that, his own style is deeply touched by colloquial American English. I say in my book that Mencken had the first great colloquial American prose style of the 20th century. So even though he wasn't a man who said ain't, he was a man who was alive to the vitality and the originality of the colloquial idiom. And in this wonderful and famous parody, The Declaration, we get a sense of Mencken feeling that the American language is alive and open to change. It's one of the most striking things about it.
Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go next to Worcester, Massachusetts, and David's calling in. Hi, David.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just I missed the first part of the show, and I don't know if you've already touched on it, but does the book deal very much with Mencken and the anti-censorship movement and the band in Boston and the Boston Watch and Ward Society in the 1920s?
I'm glad you asked that.
It's where it came from,
because
right? Because,
in fact, Mencken was himself banned. The American Mercury was banned in Boston by the Watch and Ward Society. Right after the Scopes trial, Mencken had published in the Mercury a short story by Herbert Asbury, who is in the news now, by the way, because he's the man who wrote Gangs of New York, the book out of which the film was made. But back then, Asbury was just a newspaper reporter who came from a small Missouri town, and he felt the same way that Mencken did about Puritanism. And he wrote a story about a small town prostitute named Hatrack. And Mencken published it because he liked to publish anything that pulled the tails of small-town Americans. And this story caught the attention of the Reverend J. Frank Chase, who was running the Watch and Ward Society of Baltimore. Now, Mencken had also been pulling the Reverend Chase's tail.
Of Baltimore or Boston?
Or Boston,
right.
Boston. Mencken had also been pulling the Reverend Chase's tail in the Mercury. He had been running stories about how dreadful it all was. Mencken was, of course, passionately opposed to censorship in all its forms. So when Chase got his hands on that issue of the Mercury, he banned it for sale in Boston. Now, Mencken had just finished up with the Scopes trial, and he was tired, and he was initially not disposed to deal with this, but the more he thought about it, the more he thought that this was something he could not let get by. So he consulted with his ACLU friends with whom he had been working on the Scopes trial, and he came up to Boston and into the square bearing a copy of that issue of the American Mercury, and by prearrangement sold it to Chase. Who arrested him. Chase gave him, I forget what it was, a quarter or whatever, whatever the Mercury cost then, and Mencken bit it in front of him just to make sure that it wasn't counterfeit. And Chase took him off to the courthouse. And this was no joke. This was no publicity stunt. Mencken could have done prison time for selling Chase that copy of the Mercury. Went before the judge. The judge spent the night considering it, and the next day he dismissed the case. But that was one of Mencken's most spectacular instances in which he put his money where his mouth was.
David, are you a fan of Mencken's?
Oh, yes, very much so. I'd done some work as an undergraduate. And there was just, if I could just bring up one little obscure point that I think is interesting that ties directly into this.
We do lots of obscure points here on The Connection.
Love them.
Okay. Frank Chase was the head of the Boston Watch and Ward Society. Frederick Lewis Allen, author of Only Yesterday, is very very brief with Mencken, just says, oh, he was just a sophomore nihilist in his book. What he forgot to mention in the book was that his own father had been the head of the Boston Watch and Ward Society.
I had no idea. I mention, of course, Only Yesterday in this book quite prominently. In the way that Fred Allen tried to place Mencken in his time. But I had no idea that Allen had a connection to the Watch and Ward. Oh. That is a wonderful piece of trivia.
Watch for it in the second edition.
In the paperback.
David, thanks for your call.
I thank you.
1-800-423-8255.
You never do know when you'll find out something interesting.
Never. No, this is the cool part of the program. Plainfield, Vermont. Michelle's on the line. Hi, Michelle.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
I wanted to make some comments, and then I was interested in hearing what the author thought of these of this.
Okay.
That Mencken seems to... I'm a person who I've read... I'm pretty widely read, and I also... I'm not alcoholic, but I've worked a lot with alcoholic men. And he seems to me to be someone who... He lived with his mom, who must have thought he was the Ritz. He never
she
took
sure
a
did.
Hurt what? She did,
she
I'm
sure.
She sure
did, yeah.
My little God. He never took a personal risk in his life that I have ever heard of. And then he drank the rest of the time. And a lot of people who drink too much think that they're the top and everyone else's opinions are not very important. And that seems to me certainly a large part of him that how would you that to me casts a certain shadow on his opinions. And so I was interested in what you thought of that part of his personality. What you think sort of negative aspects of a personality can say about a person's opinions or place in literary pantheon.
Right. Well, in drinking, as in virtually every other aspect of his private life, Mencken talked a much better game than he played. He did declare himself to be, this was his word, omnibibulous. But in truth, he was very firm about not drinking while working. He never took a drink until the sun went down. He really liked to talk about it more than he liked to do it, although he did lift quite a few schooners on Saturday nights when his chamber music club met. Your observation, however, is very interesting. Mencken was without doubt a mama's boy. He was the apple of her eye. He lived with her until her death, and he was just shy of 50 when that happened. He didn't marry until after she died. He basked in the confidence. I think it's Freud who says that the prerequisite for success in a man is that his mother should admire him, and Mencken had that in spades. And it probably... I wouldn't be surprised if it desensitized him to other aspects of life. But there's certainly nothing in his real life, as opposed to his writing life, to indicate that he had any kind of trouble with alcohol. That was not true.
Thanks for your call, Michelle, to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Now Mike's on the line. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hi. I've been reading Mencken's Christomathy. I've been enjoying him a lot. But a problem I have a question for Mr. Teachout. It seems to me that Mencken often wrote for comic effect, obviously with exaggeration and hyperbole. He reminds me of an insult comedian. My question
That's wonderful.
Is,
I really like that. I'm stealing that.
my question is, did he ever write seriously about law and government? Or can Mr. Teachout point us to anything that would carry a more serious presentation of his views on these subjects?
Well, Mencken always wrote with a comic touch. In fact, John Yardley, when he reviewed my book in The Atlantic, said that he thought that Mencken would ultimately be remembered as a humorist. And I think there's something to that. But the comedy was at all times motivated by deeply serious views. And Mencken's most serious discussion of the problems of law and government is to be found in a book called Notes on Democracy, published in 1926. It's probably the least known of his full-length books, and I think it's the most underrated one. I spend quite a bit of time talking about it in The Skeptic. One may take leave to differ with what he says there, and it certainly does have its knockabout aspect, but it is perfectly serious. I think most great humorists are terribly serious people. At bottom, and there's no doubt that Mencken was too, but that he wrote for comic effect, we may have no doubt of that, as the passage I read earlier, I think, makes clear.
Thank you.
Yes,
thanks
sir.
For your call, Mike. Nice to have you on the program. Tell me whether or not you think that the tone or the style of a Mencken exists in the journalism that we consume today. I'm not looking so much for a name as just to, you know, whether or not that I really don't give a hoot about what you think about what I write. This is how I see what I see.
There's not much of that. We live in a polite age. A horseman would say we live in a soft-mouthed age. We don't like to give offense. Mencken loved to give offense. And I think people often ask me, you know, could Mencken get a job at a newspaper today? And, of course, the simple answer to that is, well, no, he didn't even have a college degree. But
Didn't go to J school.
But he would have scared off a lot of contemporary editors. But that doesn't mean that the tone is completely missing or the attitude. And I must say that I think that in his novels, Tom Wolfe touches on this determination, as I said earlier, to write about men as they are rather than as they wish to be seen. And while Mencken only dabbled in fiction, he wrote it as a young man and didn't pursue it, I think he might, had he lived long enough, been very proud to have written a book like The Bonfire of the Vanities, which really has a Menckenian attitude toward politics and public life and the life of a city. If we have, well, I mean, A.J. Liebling, I think, followed in Mencken's footsteps in the 40s and 50s. And if we have a contemporary writer today who has a touch of Mencken about him, I think it's Wolfe.
And do you think that we're the poorer for not necessarily having that voice? Or do you think that his was a time when he was testing boundaries of the relationship of the public and the press and the politicians in a way that we don't actually have the... Well, I'll let you pick it up from there because, I mean, again, it was a print age. It wasn't an electronic age, and it's hard for us to think back to a time when, you know, the presence of the electronic media wasn't as it is today.
Well, Mencken knocked down a lot of walls in the 20s, the walls of the genteel society and the genteel tradition in American literature. He'll always be remembered for that. His historical significance is unquestionable. But if we are to still read him, and we do still read him, his books are still in print, and he's still a very popular writer, it's got to be because of something enduring that is of interest to us. And I think it is the style. I think it is the tremendous vitality and presence and gusto, which I know I, for one, find tonic in a time when people are awfully reluctant to say exactly what they think. That doesn't mean that I endorse all or necessarily even most of what Mencken thought about any given subject. But as Richard Wright, who greatly admired Mencken and was influenced by him as a young man, said, what amazed him was not so much what Mencken said as that he had the courage to say it and to say it in that way. And I think that that courage is still something that comes through to us today and that maybe we could use a little more of, maybe even a lot more of.
And if you were to, having spent the amount of time with his writing that you have, pick one up for a quiet winter Sunday afternoon, couple of hours with Mencken, which one would you pick up?
My two favorite books that Mencken wrote are the two autobiographical reminiscences that he wrote in the 30s and originally published in The New Yorker. The first one is called Happy Days, and it's about his childhood. And the second is called Newspaper Days, and it's about his early days as a reporter. There, he's not writing about the cut and thrust of politics, about the evils of politicians, about any of the hot-button issues. But he's writing about his life, the life that he loved, the place that he loved, Baltimore at the turn of the century. And the things about his writing that bother so many people, they just kind of disappear, and we're left with the beautiful style and the exciting personality. That's what I curl up and read Mencken for.
Terry, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Terry Teachout, writer, critic, author of The Skeptic, A Life of H.L. Mencken. Connection listeners in the Boston area, Terry's going to be talking about H.L. Mencken tonight in the Boston Athenaeum at 6 p.m. We had help with our program today from Kim Bichari, Darren Manoogian, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program's produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is W.